Welcome to the Dirt on Data podcast, where we explore how to unlock the data needed to transform agriculture for smallholder farmers around the world. Our co-hosts, Richard Charlatan and Drew Whedon, talk to the people, businesses, researchers, and visionaries leading the ag data revolution. Along with our partners and collaborators, we explore the creative new ideas and innovations that improve food security, build sustainable and inclusive food systems, and catalyze a vibrant agricultural data ecosystem.
Welcome to the Dirt on Data. I'm Drew Whedon. Today, we're welcoming Hamed Al-Mohamed, Executive Director and Chief Data Scientist at Radiant Earth Foundation. Hamed is an expert in applications of machine learning and geospatial analytics. He serves as a member of the American Geophysical Union's Technical Committee on Remote Sensing and worked as a postdoctoral research scientist at Columbia University and MIT. As the executive director of Radiant Earth Foundation, Hamed empowers programmers and the global development community to address the world's most critical challenges in agriculture, conservation, and climate change, using high-quality and trustworthy machine learning and earth observation data standards and tools. Hi, Hamed. Welcome.
Hi, Drew. Happy to be here.
Great to have you. Okay, so just to kick things off, Hamed, could you just explain how does Radiant Earth Foundation support crop analytics for smallholder farmers, and how would you define your organization's role within the overall agricultural data chain?
Absolutely. Radiant is a nonprofit organization. In that sense, we act, I would say, as an enabler and catalyzer in this ecosystem of crop analytics. Our goal and our mission is really to support various players from the end users to the customers to the service providers to be able to tap into a trustworthy and ML-ready set of data sets and models to provide insights to decision makers and policymakers. The way we do that is, first of all, acting as that catalyzer, bringing different players and different actors together, providing an ecosystem of open training data sets and models as it relates to using, for example, remote sensing data and building crop detection models. And all of these in an open source and open access fashion. So anybody can tap into our resources. Anybody can also publish their data on MLHub. And we also go into collaboration and partnerships with various players around the world to make sure they can tap into the latest technologies and knowledge around this. When you think about the data value chain, as you ask, it has four phases. You start from collection, then you have publication, then you have uptake, and then you have impact. I mean, some terminology is named this differently, but broadly speaking, these are the four phases. Where we see our role is mostly in the middle, the publication and uptake. So we work with ecosystems and companies across this chain, but our primary role is really in the publication and uptake. So I can summarize our role in kind of three pillars of activity. One is an actual hub, which is called Radiant ML Hub. It's a cloud-based training data repository. And as of about 4 months ago, we also have a model repository. So anybody from anywhere around the world can come to ML Hub, access existing data sets. And I would say, first of all, can search and discover existing data and then access them and then use them for their application of interest. Second pillar is that community side, because we want to make sure we have a way of doing things, whether it's about best practices, whether it's about guidelines, whether it's about standards. We get together and we develop those. And last but not least is also on education and capacity development. We do a lot of activities around that to make sure people can benefit from this and get to know it. One last thing I will add is this thing needs integrations, because we don't want to be just one node which is standalone for itself within this community. So we try to build a lot of connections both on the data collection side and on the impact side. So users can easily feed data to ML Hub, and they can also easily extract data from ML Hub and use it in their products.
Great. Thanks very much for that explanation. Do you want to talk a little bit more about what specifically you're doing in that space of integration and making that flow of data as easy as possible for those who are looking to build derived analytics or similar products from it?
Absolutely. Let me start with intake. So imagine you're underground. You want to go underground, have a campaign, collect reference data, for example, for crop types, and build a high quality reference data to train a machine learning model. What we have done in the last year or so, was a tool called the ECAS Field Mapper, which is basically an ODK app with a set of standard questions to collect reference data on agricultural practices. The way we did that was, again, working with various stakeholders in the ecosystem to make sure we capture common set of common denominators, I would say, for the questions that would feed into the analytics, put them into standard form, publish it on ODK. And then after that, on the Radiant side, we have built an ingestion pipeline. So if you go and collect that data set using the standard ECAS form, you can feed that to ML Hub if you want to do that and publish it using a standard metadata set and publish it on ML Hub. So we have streamlined the process from being on the ground, collecting reference data, to getting a ML-ready training data that you can feed to your model. Using these pipelines, we are now actually collecting data in India. We have another project, again, supported by the ECAS initiative, jointly with our collaborators at ID Insight. And we are now collecting agricultural reference data, in particular, crop types and field boundary in four states in northern India. This is really on the collection to publication phase, but we have done a lot on the uptake as well. So we have built, for example, integrations with cloud providers, with those ecosystems that provide the compute resource, so users can easily extract data out of ML Hub and then use it into their applications, whether it's model development or validation purposes.
You talked a little bit about some of the common denominators that are captured within the form. And I'm just wondering if you could expand upon that a little bit and give a few more examples and maybe talk about why some parameters or denominators are more important than others and why we prioritize the selection.
Very good question. So, I mean, when you think about agricultural analytics at a scale, you want to use remote sensing data, for example, and for that, you need good quality reference data on the ground. What is good quality? And that's probably the question we're getting into, but that feeds into, okay, what are those common denominators? First and foremost, you want to have a data which is geotagged and timestamped, because it is important to know this observation that I'm making about a specific crop type or yield or what other basically phenomena you're collecting, where was it collected and when was it collected? Because then you can match that with the corresponding satellite imagery of the same space and time. So part of our focus in that design of the ODK field mapper was to make sure we collect the right information on the ground. How do you walk around the field and collect the field boundary, for example? How to ensure that has the highest quality? Collecting extra kind of auxiliary information like the center point of the field to make sure we can correspond those to each other, the field boundary and the center point, making sure, oh, it has enough accuracy that I can use it and map it. Beyond this kind of metadata about the space and time, we talked about consent. Making sure when you're collecting your reference data, it's farmers' metadata you're collecting. You inform them about the purpose of data collection, how the data will be used, and potentially how it will be shared. So collecting all those consent information and informing the farmer so you have the right licensing at the end. Beyond that, it was about the agricultural variables. For example, crop type was definitely the primary one because without that, you can't do anything. That's included. The growth stage and kind of planting dates is another one. And then the last one was yield, which we included. The question is there, but sometimes it's optional because we know yield is also a very extensive process. Doing crop cuts and everything, it's not something that every campaign can do.
Great, thanks. And I'll use the reference of yield as a bit of a leading question into the next, which is, you know, we heard, I think in the first episode of the Dirt on Data, we heard a little bit about the importance of standards and guidelines, especially for things such as yield measurement and reporting, which is done differently all over the place. So I'd like to hear your kind of take on this, you know, the importance of standards and guidelines, maybe some of the work that you're doing in this space and where we see it progressing as well.
Yeah, so I mean, there are two types of standardization and practices, I think, in this ecosystem, which are evolving, and I will mention what we have done, but they work hand in hand, but they address two different things. One is on what to collect and how to collect. As you mentioned, yield, you can collect it in various ways. Even the crop yield, which you do crop cuts, how many points should I collect on the ground? Where should I sample them? There's a lot of kind of decisions to be made when you are on the ground. The guidelines that are supporting this thing is more of a framework than a step-by-step guide, because each field will need its own way of doing the sampling. So you would have a step-by-step decision points, like a decision tree for the expert on the ground to do that sampling and collecting the data, making sure they collect the right metadata associated with that. For example, if it's a yield, are you collecting in kilograms or in pound? Kind of very simple nuances that sometimes we receive a data and you see, oh, it is not there and I don't know how to use the data. And we have tried to add some of these practices there. Informing the surveyors, making sure they are aware of the uses of the data was really things that we have invested in. We started this back in 2018, and the interest from our side was that we started receiving data from various players that had already collected data. We wanted to publish them on MLHub. Out of about 30 data sets that we received at that point, only three had the right metadata documentation and information that you could actually publish the data as a high quality training data. The rest were missing some sort of metadata. So that encouraged us to publish these. So we have a guideline which is on ground referencing. It's on our GitHub repository. It talks about these basics of how to walk a field, how to think about field boundary, how to standardize your questions. And that was what we used actually in the ODK field mapper and kind of helped us to do that guiding. So that's one standardization. The second one is on the publication side. You want to publish your data, you want to put it on the cloud, you need to have a standard way of recording your metadata. So it's both a machine readable and it can support kind of human readable documentation. And that's the spatiotemporal asset catalog or stack that we have kind of led as a community effort since 2014. It has more than 30, 35 organizations contributing to that. We have been only the catalyzer again in that ecosystem. And now we are using it on MLHub as well.
I want to call something out that you said just now, which is really a remarkable statistic, which is that when you started out, you said that 10% of the data sets that you received were actually usable. I don't think, at least in my opinion, we're ever going to get to a point where every data set is always going to be usable for those who want to share it. But I wonder if we can somehow, you know, reverse those numbers and get to the point where maybe 10% are not usable and shareable. We get 90% that are. And so, you know, I just wonder, as you think about the progress that you're making, are there any specific steps or anything that you'd want to call out that can help you reverse those numbers?
Definitely. I mean, that's our hope. But one thing I want to highlight before answering your question is some of these data weren't collected for the purpose of analytics, and that was part of the problem. They have been on the ground. The purpose has been doing a survey. They have collected all the metadata you can imagine for a reference data other than the location, for example. So for analytics, that's useless because you can't point that row of the table to a point on the ground to say, oh, now I can find the corresponding satellite imagery and build an analytic model at a scale. But they had all the other metadata. This was many of the cases we saw. So that's one thing to make sure we broadcast this use across the community. So if a data set is being collected for another purpose, by maybe 2%, 5% more effort, we can address a much broader use case. And that was part of, I would say, the influence we have made in the community talking about this thing, that, hey, there is value in collecting more of these data. And initiatives like ECAS, initiatives like Lacuna Fund that are specifically supporting data collection and enforcing the right metadata throughout the proposal stage, the review stage, the contracting stage, until the publication phase, I think is the needed thing to move forward. We need to think about this thing from the beginning. It shouldn't be an afterthought. When you're designing a data collection campaign, you need to think about what is the usage? Can I do a little more to address a broader use case? Do I have resources to do that? And then making sure you publish it at the end with the right information out there. Certainly we have progress, but I think we have a long way to go.
Hamid, could you tell us a little bit more about how Radiant Earth is using synthetic data to complete or complement ground data collection efforts? And, you know, what does this mean? And also, what's the impact of using this synthetic data?
Yeah, so when you think about agricultural reference data, you need to have representation. You need to collect data from the right place, the right time. The problem is we can't be everywhere on the earth at any time and collect all the data we need. Some places are hard to get to. Some places might be limited accessibility for various reasons. Either it's a disaster or a humanitarian situation, and you can't be on the ground. So we need to have a way of augmenting or complementing our existing data to expand its representation and have a better model. This is actually a field that has advanced a lot in the machine learning side of things. When you look at the many applications in the computer vision, natural language processing, there is a wealth of literature that has been working on synthetic data, which is a data you would generate randomly, but try to represent the real world in it, the distribution of the real world in there. And that's what we embarked on about 2 years ago with a grant from the Grand Challenges Initiative by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation to use existing limited agricultural data that we have access to and build synthetic data, which means synthetic label or a crop type and a synthetic satellite imagery, and then use that to augment our limited data and build a classification model for crop type, which was the application we were interested in. And we have shown through this progress and evaluations that actually doing this augmentation with limited data benefits the model, and the model will perform well or perform better on the real world, basically validation data. That's how we are doing that. We have succeeded. It's definitely a proof of concept. We are not embarking at an operational product yet, but we see a very promising future for use of synthetic data.
Absolutely. Let's open it up a little bit, and I just want to ask you what developments or innovations in this space, especially at the intersection of increasingly accessible and usable data and these advanced analytics for smallholders, what are you most excited about? What are you seeing a lot of opportunity in, and where are you thinking things can be pushed to really see some impact at scale?
There are, I think, two areas that I'm really excited about, and I've seen some progress in the last couple of years, and I feel we will see significant progress in the years to come, maybe in the 3 to 5 year window. One is on the analytics side. There has been a lot of progress on using even existing limited reference data that we have to build very high quality agricultural monitoring models. And I say monitoring broadly because it can be crop type, cropland, crop yield. Certainly on the cropland and crop type, there has been more effort because there is more data there. But we are not yet benefiting from all the remote sensing data that we are collecting. Just imagine Sentinel-2 is one of the typical multispectral satellite data that people use because it's the best spatial resolution open access data you can get globally. You get a measurement from Sentinel-2 every 5 days. So every location on Earth has a measurement every 5 days. We are not using that information that we are receiving to the best of it. And definitely there is a geographical bias. I feel in the developed world, that data set is being used more than developing regions. But even in the developed world, that is not being used to the best of its benefit and the ability that can provide. So I see a window of opportunity in the 3 to 5 year that we will have analytic models that will benefit from these stream of data, because this is a stream. This is not just one single image. Using that time series, understanding the dynamics, the phenology of the crops, and being able to not only look at the current condition, but do predictions. So, for example, 1 month to the growing season, you can look at the progress of the crop and estimate what will be the yield toward the end of the season. And the second pillar is the scalable data collections, because these models need data. They are data hungry. We are seeing very innovative ways of data collection, whether it's combinations of drone and satellite imagery, doing annotation on satellites and then going on the ground, augmenting that with the labels or other methods of data collection, which are really helping us scale training data. That's, I think, where we will see actually more rapid innovation in the next maybe 2 to 3 years.
That's great. Thanks. So on this first example that you provided, Ahmed, about using the data stream that's already out there to a greater extent than we are now, do you have any other examples that you see maybe emerging that you could point to just to help people make this more tangible for them?
Yeah, so I mean, I can give you one example of how we are using that daily data in another application and how we can potentially use it in agriculture. The existing usage is in monitoring deforestation. So there are dashboards out there like Global Forest Watch that are regularly kind of ingesting every new satellite imagery and immediately running an algorithm under, was there a change between the previous image that they collected 5 days ago and the new one? So they immediately look at change there. In agriculture, we can use the same feed, not necessarily for a change detection, because change in agriculture will happen seasonally, not necessarily every 5 days. But looking at the pattern of how the basically crop phenology is progressing and potentially comparing that to a potential average, because we have the historical data, we can look at the historical performances and see, oh, is the crop underperforming compared to the kind of average years or the kind of more productive years, or it's actually outperforming? And what is the implication of that in terms of the yield and the food security toward the end of the season? So we are using in some of the remote sensing and geospatial domains, but not to the best of it, I would say, and particularly not in agriculture at scale.
Great, thanks. So Ahmed, I'd be curious to hear, what is something that's not obvious, an insight that's not obvious about the work that you're doing in the crop analytics space, what you're seeing others do, that you'd really like the community to know about and for listeners to understand?
I think one thing I would like to share is how we communicate the performance or the accuracy of our products and services, particularly when it comes to analytics. I've seen, for example, a product presentation that talks about X, let's not name them. It can be anything in agriculture, crop type, crop yield, and you get a R-score of 0.8, like as a performance metric. R-score is basically a measure of how predictions are similar to the real-world validation data. That's it. That's what the company or the group is kind of presenting and communicating to the end user. Honestly, I feel we should do much better than that. First of all, R-score doesn't have a meaning for the stakeholder in the end, right? They want to know what is the implication, what is the impact of that accuracy on their decision. If the model is doing wrong, how wrong would it be, and what is the impact on the policy making? That's the translation we need to do that we are not doing right now. Secondly, we should be careful with that communication, because I see a risk of us doing this validation and performance evaluation on data sets that are not representative. The name of this podcast is Dirt on Data. Agriculture data is really dirty. It's really hard to work with this data and have high quality data sets. So when we are performing an analysis for kind of evaluation and reporting accuracy, we need to be careful. What is that data set we are building this evaluation based on? Is it representative of, for example, drought years and wet years? Or is it just a normal year that we are doing the evaluation on? And then communicate the right thing to the stakeholder, because the risk will be, if we only do this evaluation, for example, based on average years, and our model is performing actually pretty well in there, but then there's a drought year and the model doesn't perform well, the stakeholder will be definitely disappointed in the product. And at large, we will see implications across the community that they might lose the trust in this application. And that's honestly, going back to the first question, that's one of the mission and interests for us to having these open benchmarks and accessible data sets that everybody can see, oh, this is actually the range of representation in the data. This is how I can benchmark. It's open data set. I can trace it back to the original. You can see the provenance of the data, the provenance of the model, and the product. So that's where I hope we go there as a community, communicating and translating that correctly, and also doing it in the right way with the right representation in the data.
Yeah. I think that's a critical need as well. Taking this out of the realm of purely kind of data scientists and agricultural specialists, and expanding both the nomenclature and also the products that are coming out, so that it makes sense for a wider group of decision makers and stakeholders. And actually, that's something I wanted to ask you to elaborate on from your opening introductory remarks. You talked about some of the analytics and the decision makers. Could you maybe give a couple of examples of either projects or teams that you think are doing maybe a pretty good job of taking these findings and these products and translating them into really practical use for less technical audiences?
Definitely there are good examples, and I will name them. And I think when you look at the pattern in those organizations and applications, they engage with the stakeholder from the beginning. And I think that's the key piece. You engage with them, you understand the problem, you understand their limitations and restrictions, and you also understand the opportunities and potentially the availability of any data. If you do that, it's usually a higher chance, I would say, a very good chance that you succeed in building the right application, doing the right translation, and providing them what they need. Examples of that, I think NASA Harvest has done a very good job in there, particularly when you look at the portfolio of projects they have had. The majority of the cases, they're engaging with the stakeholder on the ground. That's definitely a good example of that. There are other examples that you see service providers at a smaller scale. I mean, for example, Plant Village is one of them, who is working one-on-one with farmers on the ground, providing, again, it's analytic and it's kind of at a scale because it's distributed across the country, but they are doing it with a very much custom design, locally designed app for the farmers, who can monitor their crops, take a picture, and also provide a recommendation to them. These are the two examples in the two end of the spectrum, on the analytic at the scale, remote sensing side, and on the ground with the farmers working one-on-one.
That was a good answer. Okay, I think that's a wrap. Ahmed, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a real pleasure.
Absolutely. Thank you, Drew.
Today, we heard from Hamed about the role that the Radiant Earth Foundation is playing in, especially in the publication and uptake components of the data chain and what that means for end use cases and applications. The work that the Radiant Earth Foundation is doing in scaling use of standards and guidelines, such as STAC standards that Hamed mentioned. The importance of building the right kinds of products and services with stakeholders engaged from day one to make sure that they're practical, useful, and applicable in the field. And finally, the difficulties and importance of very clearly articulating things like product and service accuracy and translating this into the kind of language that makes sense for non-technical audiences and people who don't have master's degrees in data science. That's it for today. Tune in next month as we discuss the principles and practicalities of open data within the smallholder farming context. We'll be chatting with Ruthie Musker, an expert in data policies and practice, as we continue to bring you the dirt on data.
The Dirt on Data is produced by the staff of Tetra Tech's Enabling Crop Analytics at Scale initiative and supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Our special thanks to our guest this week, Hamed Alomohamed. You can follow Hamed and Radiant Earth's work on the web at www.radiant.earth. To receive the latest and greatest news from the ECAS project, remember to follow us on Twitter at ECAS_AgData or visit our website at cropanalytics.net.